hundreds of miles away. For all Ruby knew, Charlotte could have been picked up already, shot to death. Ruby gagged and heaved at the thought and tried to push it away. But she couldn't sleep that night without seeing Charlotte being tortured.
"Are you all right?"
Nadia asked her the next day, after their contingent of prisoners had been marched from Ravensbrück to the factory in the hazy light of early morning. They settled next to each other on the assembly line and whispered, as they often did, when the guards' backs were turned.
"I'm just thinking of someone I left behind," Ruby replied. The letter to her parents was folded and pressed into her underclothes, just in case she was searched on the way in, but the guards seemed distracted this morning.
"Your beau?"
Ruby smiled. "No, there is a man, but..." She trailed off and shook her head. How could she explain Thomas to anyone? It all still felt like a dream to her, like he'd never been real at all. "No, Nadia, I was thinking of a girl who's very important to me. Her parents left her with me 2 years ago when they were taken, and she's become like a sister to me. Maybe a daughter, even. I worry about her every day."
"And there is someone hiding her?"
"There is a boy looking out for her. He's only 16, but he loves her."
Nadia's expression softened.
"How extraordinary to find love in the midst of war."
Ruby nodded, again thinking of Thomas.
"Extraordinary indeed. She will be all right, then."
Ruby had to laugh at the certainty in her friend's voice.
"I wish I had your optimism. You seem so sure about the future."
A guard passed by then, glaring at them, and Ruby pretended to be deeply absorbed in her work. When he was gone, Nadia nudged her.
"I am not sure of anything, but if we don't have hope, we don't have anything."
"I wish I had your hope, then."
"You do," Nadia said.
At Ruby's confused expression, she smiled.
"That is what my name means, hope. So, as long as you have Nadia, you have hope."
Ruby smiled. It was a nice thought, the idea that hope itself could be embodied in a person. She was silent for a moment as another guard passed by.
"Herr Hartmann has offered to send a letter home to my parents for me. You don't think it's a trap, do you?"
Nadia bit her lip.
"No, I do not.
I think he is a good man who feels terrible about the things that are happening to us."
"Then why doesn't he do something to stop it?"
"You don't think he wants to?
You don't think there are many Germans who want to?
I think that in a place like this, the system itself has grown so huge that it's impossible to stop. Like a snowball that starts at the top of a mountain and has turned into a boulder by the time it reaches the bottom. I think, though, that there are people, like Herr Hartmann, trying to make a difference on a smaller level, with people like us. I think you can trust him."
"So do I."
Later that afternoon, Ruby passed by Herr Hartmann in the corner of the factory and slipped him the letter.
"Thank you," she whispered.
"It is the least I can do, Ruby," he said gravely. "None of you should have to endure this."
"But how can you stand to work for the Gestapo, to run an assembly line that produces weapons for the Nazis?"
He frowned, and for a moment she was sure she had overstepped her bounds. But after a pause, he shook his head.
"I manage just enough breakdowns in the assembly line that I slow the production of weapons. It's not much, Ruby, but it's something. We all must do what we can, don't you think? It is the only way good has a chance of winning in the end."
By mid-August, Ruby had heard that prisoners who could no longer pull their weight were being killed immediately, their bodies cremated in enormous furnaces that sent cruel clouds of black smoke belching into the sky. The smell of burning flesh lingered in the air. Ruby was nearly 8 months pregnant, but she didn't look that way. Her belly was half the size it had been during her first pregnancy. She was only 5 or 6 weeks away from being full term, and yet if she stood just the right way, the cotton of her loose dress skimmed the air, keeping her secret safe. The guards at the factory were distracted much of the time anyhow,
and they didn't seem to be as focused on abusing the prisoners as the guards inside the camp had been. Death no longer lurked around the corner quite as hungrily as it had when Ruby had worked inside the main camp, but at the same time, falling ill would land a prisoner back inside the gates, and if you remained in the hospital block for too long, the rumor was that you were sent directly to your death. That's what had happened to Denise, a young, quiet French girl who worked several stations down from Ruby on the assembly line. One day she'd been coughing, the next she was gone. It had taken a week before word came back that she had been diagnosed with rheumatic fever and condemned to die. The factory workers had held a secret moment of silence for her on Tuesday, and by the end of that day, Ruby was horrified to realize that she, too, had a nagging tickle in her throat. "I think I might be getting ill," she said to Nadia that night as they settled down to sleep. Her throat was raw and scratchy, and she could feel herself beginning to perspire. Nadia put a cool hand on her forehead.
"Ruby, you're burning up."
"Fever?" Nadia nodded, her expression grave. Ruby struggled upright. "But I can't be sick. My illness could hurt the baby."
Nadia frowned. "I am more concerned about what will happen if they bring you to the hospital block. They certainly won't miss your pregnancy this time."
She was silent for a moment.
"You must tell Herr Hartmann."
"What?"
"You must tell him,"
Nadia said more insistently.
"He has helped you before, Ruby. He will not let you die."
"But what can he do?" Ruby was crying now. She'd been strong for such a long time, but she was suddenly so tired. She felt the heat of her fever surge within her.
"I don't know, but I think it is your only chance."
The next morning, Ruby felt even worse. Her face was hot, and the world seemed to be spinning. Before she left the barracks, she put her hands on her belly and whispered a prayer.
"I don't know if you can hear me, God, but please, save my baby."
She bit back tears, splashed water on her face, and headed out to roll call, praying that the guards wouldn't notice her illness. Fortunately, they didn't, but that meant only a brief reprieve. Ruby could tell as the morning wore on that she was getting worse. Her hands shook as she tried to piece together electrical parts, and she could feel sweat dripping from her brow. Her mouth was dry, so dry, and she thought that if she dared close her eyes, she might never open them again.
"You must go to Herr Hartmann now," Nadia whispered as midday approached. "You have no choice, Ruby. The guards will notice your condition very soon if you do not."
"It is my only option?" Ruby asked. Nadia nodded.
"I think so, yes."
And so, Ruby rose shakily after the next time the guard walked by, and she made her way toward the back corner of the building where she'd seen Herr Hartmann heading a few minutes earlier. It was a struggle to walk straight without leaning into the wall. She had to concentrate hard so that the floor in front of her didn't reach up to drag her down. By some miracle, she found Herr Hartmann alone, going over several pages of notes with a furrowed brow. He looked up when she approached.
"Ruby," he said, smiling,
but his expression quickly turned as she stumbled forward.
"My God," he said, reaching out a hand to steady her. "What's wrong?"
"I'm ill," she whispered.
"Yes, that much is clear. The gods haven't noticed yet."
"No, but I'm afraid I might not have much time." He was still holding her arm.
"And what will happen? They will send you to the hospital block?"
She took a deep breath, which made her cough. It was time to tell him the truth.
"Herr Hartmann, I am pregnant."
He glanced at her belly, and then up at her face again, a deep well of sympathy in his eyes.
"Yes, I know."
"You do?
I could see it the day I hired you, Ruby. How far along are you?"
She coughed again.
"Nearly 8 months."
His eyes widened.
"I thought perhaps 4 or 5.
She shook her head.
"We are starving, Herr Hartmann. It's a miracle my baby is still alive." "A miracle, indeed."
He studied her.
"And if you go to the hospital block and they realize you're pregnant?"
"Death, I think."
"Dear God,"
he murmured, raking a hand through his hair. She could see a storm of indecision in his eyes, and for the first time, she realized how unfair this was. She was asking him to do something that would put his own life in danger. and what obligation did he have to help her?
"Ruby," he said at long last, "you must leave today. There's no other choice."
His tone was so firm that she almost wanted to laugh, as if it were that easy to simply walk away.
"But how?" she whispered.
He thought for a moment.
"Meet me here at 4 o'clock. I'll have an answer then."
He strode away before Ruby could reply. The next few hours ticked by, and as Ruby had told Nadia about Herr Hartmann's words, they were both wondering about what he could be planning. It wasn't as if a woman in prison could simply stroll out into the afternoon sunshine and make a home for herself in the German countryside. And while the primary concern was getting out of the factory unnoticed, Ruby would still have to deal with her raging fever.
"I will come with you to talk to him," Nadia said firmly as the hands on the wall clock inched toward 4. "Someone must protect you. Let us see what Herr Hartmann is planning, and I will do what I can to help."
Ruby was too weak to protest, although she was terribly afraid that Nadia would be putting herself in unnecessary danger. She hoped, of course, that Herr Hartmann would talk Nadia into going back to work. After all, Ruby had nothing to lose. Death was a certainty if she stayed. But surely the camp would be liberated soon, and Nadia was strong, brave. She would survive. Hope, Ruby thought. Together, just before 4, the two women slipped away when the guards' backs were turned and headed toward the corner. Herr Hartmann was already there, and he looked surprised to see Nadia.
"You must return to your station," he said. "Ruby is my friend."
Her reply was immediate and firm. "I must do all that I can to help her." Herr Hartmann looked at her for a moment as if trying to decide something.
"Yes, all right."
Nadia nodded.
"What is the plan?"
He held up a cloth sack.
"You will take this with you, Ruby. It is some clothing from my 12-year-old daughter."
"You have a daughter?" Ruby asked.
"And a wife and a son."
Ruby stared at the cloth sack and then shook her head. "No, no, I can't do anything that would endanger you or your family."
"My mind is made up, as is my family's. We all know the risks. Here, Gisela's clothes should fit you. You're so very small. They'll help you to blend in. There is a place to the southeast corner of the complex where a gap is being repaired. Just large enough, perhaps, for a prisoner to make her way out if no one is watching. You must head to the woods to the east and move as quickly as you can. You won't be safe until you are far from Ravensbrück. Once you've walked for a few miles, begin looking for Red Cross trucks on the roads. It's impossible to know which Germans you can trust, but you should be able to trust the Red Cross to nurse you back to health without turning you over to the Gestapo."
"But what if I don't find one?"
"You will. I know you will. They are everywhere. You will find the Red Cross, and they will help with your fever, and they will safely deliver your baby. We have to believe in that, because there's no other way."
He handed her the sack.
"There are a few potatoes and some bread in there, as well as an empty bottle. There are plenty of creeks in the woods where you can stop for water. Now quickly, Ruby, you must go before the guards notice us talking."
"Why are you helping me?" Herr Hartmann sighed.
"Because everyone deserves a chance to live, Ruby. And because this is not the Germany I know and love. There are good German people too, you know."
"I know," Ruby whispered.
Of course, she knew. In every place evil dwelled, good could also be found. It was a truth that kept the world moving forward, through all the wars, through all the terrible machinations of mankind.
"Thank you.
You must go now."
"How will I get out without the guards seeing me?"
Herr Hartmann glanced at Nadia.
"We will create a distraction. I will reprimand her loudly, which should make the guards pay attention to us."
Ruby glanced over at Nadia, who nodded and took her hands.
"Yes, it is a good idea, but you must run as fast as you can, Ruby. Your life depends on it."
"Thank you," Ruby whispered, looking into her friend's eyes.
Nadia smiled.
"No matter what happens, Ruby, remember, I am with you. As long as you have Nadia, you have hope."
Ruby blinked a few times.
"Nadia, go,"
Nadia said firmly, glancing at Ruby's belly. If we cannot make the world a better place for the next generation, what is the point?
She kissed Ruby on the cheek, and before Ruby could respond, Nadia had begun to scream, hurling a string of Russian obscenities at Herr Hartmann.
Nadia! Ruby exclaimed, knowing that her friend wasn't just creating a diversion, she was initiating a situation for which she would surely be beaten.
Go! Nadia hissed. I accept the risk. Go and be free, Ruby!
Go!
Herr Hartmann echoed before grabbing Nadia by the arm and barking orders at her in German. As several guards began trotting in their direction, Ruby took one last look at the two brave people risking their lives for her and slipped out the back door. She sucked in a huge breath of air, brilliantly, gloriously fresh air, and began to make her way toward the edge of the complex. But a guard appeared from around the corner of the building, drew his gun, and bellowed, "Halt!" No, Ruby couldn't stop, not now, not when she was so close to freedom, not when Nadia was inside risking so much for her. So she began to run, praying that the guard would miss if he tried to shoot. From the corner of her eye, she saw Nadia's face framed in the factory's window.
Ignore me, Ruby thought even as she watched Nadia register the danger Ruby was in. Don't make things worse for yourself.
But it was too late. Still yelling Russian obscenities, Nadia burst from the same factory door Ruby had just exited and hurled herself at the guard with the gun.
No! Ruby screamed, but everything was already in motion.
I said, go, Ruby!
Nadia cried, clawing at the guard's face as he cried out in surprised pain. Ruby hesitated for a split second, knowing she should go back, wanting to do all she could to save Nadia's life. But then the baby kicked inside her, once, sharply, directly into her ribcage, and she remembered in a flash all that she was fighting for. And so she ran. She ran for the nearly invisible gap, which was just where Herr Hartmann had said it would be. Then, for the woods, even as shots rang out behind her. She ran even as she heard Nadia's strangled cry. She ran as her friend's body hit the ground, riddled with bullets. She ran and ran and ran until the factory vanished, until the canopy of trees overhead obscured the blue of the sky, until she was alone in the middle of a silent forest, certain that there were no footsteps behind her. And in the quiet, she began to sob.
No matter what happens, Ruby, remember I am with you,
Nadia's voice echoed in her head.
As long as you have Nadia, you have hope.
Chapter 41. August 1944. After the initial adrenaline of her flight had worn off, Ruby's pace slowed. There was no one following her, and the underbrush grew trickier to navigate as she moved deeper into the forest. She couldn't see the sun, and she was no longer certain of which direction she was going. Her body burned, her head throbbed, and her vision was blurry with tears.
Nadia, she repeated over and over as new tears spilled. What had her friend done?
Had she known when she encouraged Ruby to flee that this could happen? Was that what Nadia was trying to tell her? That she was prepared to die to protect her? By the time night fell, the world was spinning. Ruby stopped near a creek, filled the bottle Herr Hartmann had given her, and drank it all down. She ate half a potato, but vomited it back up almost immediately. She sat and leaned against a fallen tree, and told herself she would rest for just a few minutes before moving on. But before she knew it, the night had closed in. Sleep overtook her, and her slumber was rich with nightmares about Nadia's blood spattering the foggy German afternoon. When she awoke, daylight was streaming through the trees, and Ruby sat up with a start. How long had she been out? There was no way to know. She had no watch, and she couldn't see the position of the sun in the sky. She struggled to her feet, made her way back to the creek, and drank more water, followed by another half potato. This time, the food stayed down, but she knew she was still feverish. Her stomach swam, her forehead burned, but at least some of the dizziness had receded, which had to mean she was getting better. She changed into the dress and shoes Herr Hartmann had given her, and she was surprised to realize just how well a child's garments fit her. Had she really lost that much weight? She knew, as she looked down at her body, that the answer was yes.
She was skin, bones, and belly. Herr Hartmann had also included a kerchief, which she tied around her head, knowing that her short hair might give her away as an escaped prisoner.
Ruby sat for a few minutes to gather her strength and to talk to the baby. Then she stood and began heading in the direction she thought was west. It was possible, she realized, that she might even be trudging back in the direction of the camp, right into the arms of a search party. Then again, did they know she was missing? Perhaps the guard who had shot Nadia was humiliated that he let Ruby go. Maybe he didn't say a word to anyone. She would have been missed at roll call this morning, but by then, surely they would have considered it too late to hunt for her. She only hoped that Herr Hartmann's complicity in her escape hadn't been discovered. As she walked, Ruby begged God to deliver her safely into the hands of someone who would help her rather than turn her over to the authorities. After all, she knew that Ravensbrück wasn't near anything but the Polish border, and heading east seemed foolish. The Germans still had a stranglehold on Poland, and there were, in fact, more horrific concentration camps located there. Before she'd fled, the camp had started receiving shipments of prisoners from Auschwitz, and those women looked even more skeletal than the women at Ravensbrück. They died by the hundreds each day, some dropping dead right in the middle of their forced labor, some simply failing to wake up in the morning.
"Hush, little baby. Don't say a word," Ruby began to sing shakily as she walked, her hands protectively around her belly. "Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird don't sing, Mama's gonna buy you a diamond ring."
Ruby couldn't remember any more of the lyrics, so she sang the ones she knew again and again. Eventually, hours later, Ruby came to a broad road on the edge of the forest. She stopped in her tracks, unprepared for the risks that came with a return to civilization. But she might pass as a local laborer instead of a prisoner. The problem was that she knew very little German, only a few words. She certainly couldn't pass herself off as a German civilian, but perhaps she could make someone believe that she was a refugee from somewhere else. The other alternative was to melt back into the forest and press on in a different direction. But already, Ruby felt wildly lost, and she had the feeling she would starve to death or succumb to her fever long before she found her way to safety. No, her best bet was to try to hitch a ride with someone heading west and to hope that whoever picked her up would take pity on her. It was her only chance. She began to walk along the road, head down, heart thudding. She wasn't sure she was doing the right thing, but she was certain she had no choice. Several cars whizzed by, their drivers ignoring her entirely. And then, in the distance, she saw a small truck whose hood featured a white square emblazoned with a red cross. She blinked a few times as it drew closer, sure at first that she was imagining things. Could it be a German Red Cross vehicle? She stepped into the middle of the road and began waving her arms over her head. "Bitte stoppen!" she cried in German. "Please stop!" To her relief, the truck slowed and came to a halt beside her. The man in the driver's seat looked barely older than Charlotte, and she could see that his gaze was concerned rather than angry. It was a good sign. He said something to Ruby in German. She shook her head and murmured, "Ich verstehe nicht." "I don't understand." He tried again, repeating his words more slowly, but still she shook her head. "I'm sorry," she said in French. "I don't understand." Something in his expression changed, and he looked her up and down.
"Prisoner?"
he asked in French.
"No," she said quickly. "Laborer. Arbeiter."
The man looked skeptical, but he turned to confer in German with the other two men in the truck. Finally nodding, he turned back to her.
"Get in," he said in French, nodding to the back of the truck. "We take you as far as we go. Then you exit."
"Yes, yes, of course," Ruby said, a wave of relief sweeping over her.
"Thank you so much. Vielen Dank."
"Bitte,"
the man said with a small smile. He paused and asked in French,
"You are sick? Ill?"
Ruby's mouth went dry. Yes, the truck likely had medical supplies. But what would she do if they refused to transport her because they didn't want to be exposed to her fever? No, it was more important that she get as far away from Ravensbrück as possible. "Just very tired," she said as firmly as she could, "and hungry."
"Yes," the man said.
He turned and said something to the man in the passenger seat, who rummaged in a bag and withdrew an apple, a piece of bread, and a piece of cheese.
Here, you eat. He nodded again to the back of the truck, and Ruby, momentarily stunned by the bounty of the feast, mumbled a thank you before grabbing the food and climbing in. She ate greedily as the truck began to pull away, and although she felt nauseated, she closed her eyes and willed the food to stay down. Her baby needed it. Soon, lulled by the truck's movement, she fell into a deep sleep. It was dark by the time she awoke to a man shaking her shoulder. It was the driver of the Red Cross truck, she realized, and he was saying something to her.
I don't understand, she managed to say as she struggled upright.
You go here, he said in French. Vi go that way. He pointed down the road, and although she wasn't sure why she couldn't continue with him, she knew better than to talk back.
Thank you very much for the ride, she said. Where are we?
He took a moment to process her question.
Very near to Swiss border. Swiss is that way.
He pointed down the road in the darkness.
Switzerland?
She sat up straight now, her heart thudding. It wasn't the direction she had intended to go, but wasn't this better? Switzerland was neutral, and she'd be more likely to find help there than she would have if she'd headed north to occupied Denmark. Switzerland adjoined France, too, which meant she wasn't so far from home.
Thank you, she said to the man, who was glancing not so subtly at his watch. Danke, thank you very much.
Bitte, he said. Viel Glück. Good luck.
He helped her down, and before she had a chance to say anything else, he was already climbing back into the driver's seat, already pulling away. It wasn't until he'd gone that she realized he'd handed her another apple and another piece of cheese before he left. She wolfed down the food as she stood in the grass, trying to decide what to do. This was a smaller road than the one they'd picked her up on that morning. It was made of dirt and appeared to wind through an unpopulated rural area. If she was near the Swiss border, as the Red Cross man had said, she could feel a bit safer. Perhaps she didn't need to melt back into the forest and risk getting lost. If she stayed along the main road, maybe she'd find a safe place to sleep. Her body ached, and she sang to the baby again as she walked. Her fever, she realized, wasn't burning quite as fiercely. The sleep on the truck had been restorative, but she knew that if she let her body get depleted again, the illness could come storming back. She had to find a safe place to stop for the night. Without a watch, and without guards barking orders about where she needed to be, it was impossible to keep track of time. So it might have been 30 minutes later, or it might have been 90, but eventually, Ruby saw a farmhouse on a hill just off the road a quarter mile ahead, backlit by the glow of the moon. She picked up her pace, her mind spinning. It was late. She couldn't just knock and ask for refuge. Could she? Besides, what if the people who lived there called the authorities? But there was a small barn next to the main house, and Ruby reasoned that at the very least she could sleep for a few hours in the hay before moving on prior to daybreak. But as she approached a few minutes later, walking across what appeared to be a cornfield, the front door of the house opened, and a man emerged, holding a lantern.
"Wer ist da?"
he called into the night. Ruby cowered in the darkness, hoping he wouldn't see her. But her clothing must have caught the moonlight, for a moment later he came striding directly toward her, barking a string of threats. Or she thought they were threats, anyhow. They sounded just like the tirades the guards went on at Ravensbrück just before they pulled prisoners out of line to beat them. Ruby considered running, but she was so weak, and she knew the man would overtake her quickly. So she stumbled backward a few steps, and then began to cry, her hands raised.
"I mean, no harm," she said in English,
switching to German to add,
"Ich werde dich nicht verletzen,"
which she thought meant roughly the same thing. And then, before she could say another word, the man was standing a foot away, shining his lantern in her eyes. She shielded her face from the light. He asked her something in German, and although she couldn't understand the words, she realized he sounded less aggressive now. He had a head of bushy red hair and a full beard and mustache to match, and he was huge, easily more than 6 feet tall with broad shoulders and a thick neck. He asked her another question in German, more gently this time, and she answered in English.
"I don't speak German,"
and then repeated the same words in French. The man stared at her for a moment more before replying,
"You speak French?"
he asked in French. She blinked, weak with relief, and replied in French, "Yes, I live in France.
You speak French too?
Yes, we are not so far from the French border here.
He paused and looked her up and down.
Who are you? What are you doing here?
She trailed off, unsure of how to answer. What if he was in collusion with the Nazis?
Don't worry, he said a moment later as if reading her mind.
His tone was gentle, and there was something about him that reminded her of Herr Hartmann.
I will not hurt you. Are you running from the Nazis?
Yes, she whispered.
You will come inside then. You must rest. I think, perhaps, you have come a very long way.
Yes, but she hesitated, not sure if she could trust him.
Come.
He placed his hand on her arm. The motion was gentle, supportive.
My name is Fritz. My wife is just inside.
Ruby finally relented, letting the farmer lead her toward the house. Inside, she found a fire blazing in the hearth, and a woman about her age with long dark hair and big brown eyes cutting a piece of meat in the kitchen. The woman turned as she entered and said something in German, but Fritz spoke quickly, and the woman changed effortlessly to French.
You are an escapee, no? The woman asked,
and Ruby glanced at the man and then back at the woman. Was this a trap, after all? But before she could reply, the woman added,
Don't be frightened. We want to help you. We do not believe in the same things the Nazis believe in.
The woman exchanged looks with her husband.
We are, how do you say, fighters for freedom.
Ruby blinked back unexpected tears. She didn't know whether the woman was telling the truth, but her instinct was to believe the words.
And you, the Nazis have done much to hurt you, the woman asked.
Ruby nodded, wordless. The woman's eyes filled.
We are so very sorry. Please, have some food and get some rest here. We will figure out tomorrow how to help get you to safety.
Why? Ruby whispered.
Why would you help me?
Because no one deserves what has happened to you.
Now come, sit, eat. Tonight, you worry about nothing.
After feeding Ruby a small dinner of sausage, bread, and ale, Fritz's wife, who introduced herself as Ava, showed Ruby to a small bedroom that looked as if it had belonged to a child. Ruby awoke sometime later with a sharp pain in her abdomen. When she blinked into the unexpected daylight, she realized Ava was there beside her, holding her hand.
You are pregnant?
The woman asked gently, and Ruby struggled to sit up. Doing that made her hurt even more, and her heart thudded. What had she gotten herself into by coming here?
Why do you say that?
Ruby wanted to get up, to run away, but the sharp pain in her abdomen was back, and she cried out, inadvertently squeezing Ava's hand. The woman held tight to her.
Because you are in labor, Ava said gently. The baby is coming now.
Ruby blinked up at her. No, no, that cannot be. I must keep the baby inside. Images of her tiny dead son in the Dachet's apartment flooded back, and she was terrified. The urge to protect the child in her womb was the only thing that had gotten her this far. If she failed now, too, how would she go on? What was there to live for?
Relax, Ava said calmly. Your baby is strong. I will help you. I have helped deliver many babies in this town.
Ruby blinked a few times, losing herself to another contraction.
Please, you must make sure my baby stays safe, she murmured when she could speak again. Please, promise me.
I promise. Now, will you tell me your name, and the name of the baby's father?
Ruby could feel her own expression freezing in horror.
Don't worry, Ava said quickly. I will never betray you. But in case something happens to you, I need to know where the baby should go.
Ruby thought about this for a few seconds and nodded. Of course, she didn't want her child to wind up in an orphanage in Germany.
My name is Ruby Benoit.
She didn't mention Thomas because she didn't want to endanger him.
If something happens to me, you must contact my parents. They are in America.
America?
Ava's eyebrows shot up in surprise. She beckoned to her husband and said something in German. He appeared by her side a moment later with a piece of paper and a pen, which Ava handed to Ruby.
Here, please write their information here. But this is only in case of an emergency, Ruby. I know you will be fine.
Ruby still wasn't entirely sure she was doing the right thing, but what harm could there be in giving this woman her parents' address? She scribbled it out and then looked Ava in the eye. "Make sure the baby stays safe," Ruby said as another contraction overtook her.
"Please, it's the only thing that matters."
Ava squeezed Ruby's hand tightly.
"Ruby, you can make sure of that yourself. Now relax. Breathe with me. The baby is coming."
The last thing Ruby was aware of before drifting off into a dreamless sleep was the feeling of a great weight slipping from her body, followed by the most beautiful sound she'd ever heard, a baby's piercing wail. Ruby began to sob, and as she looked up, Ava entered her blurry field of vision cradling a tiny, squirming bundle.
"It's a girl," Ava said, smiling. "A beautiful baby girl."
Chapter 42. August 1944.
"Do you think Ruby knows?" Charlotte asked, as she and Lucien pushed through a crowd of people singing La Marseillaise on the Champs-Élysées on the last Tuesday in August.
The world had changed once again, and after a week of fighting, of tanks rolling through the streets, of gunfire ringing out in the night, Paris was free. The Allies had arrived, and now a victory parade was moving toward the Place de la Concorde. The French flag flew from the Arc de Triomphe, and American flags snapped in the breeze as U.S. servicemen grinned and blew kisses to French girls from their procession of military trucks. Parisians rushed forward with bottles of wine for the soldiers, who swigged from them, laughing.
"About the liberation?"
Lucien kept his eyes on the parade, as if he couldn't quite believe it, as if he expected something terrible to happen at any moment now. After all, just a few days earlier, the day after de Gaulle had moved into the War Ministry, German snipers had fired on a celebrating crowd just like this. Lucien's shoulders were tense, his jaw set.
"I hope so. Any little piece of faith will help sustain her."
"It won't be long until the camps are liberated too, right? Ruby will be home soon."
Lucien squeezed her hand.
"I don't know. There is still a lot of fighting to be done, Charlotte. It will take the Allies a while to move farther into Germany, I think. And if we are right about our being sent to Ravensbrück, she's very far east."
Charlotte didn't reply. He wasn't saying anything she didn't already know, of course. It was just that she needed words of hope and inspiration today.
"I would know if she was dead, wouldn't I?"
Lucien looked down at her.
"Why do you say that?"
"Because I believe it of my parents. I feel it in a way I can't explain. But I don't believe it of Ruby. She's still alive. She must be. I just know."
"Then we will believe in that. She is strong and brave, and I believe she would do anything in the world to get home to you."
"And the baby?"
Lucien shook his head.
"My love, I can't imagine the baby has survived. It's better for Ruby, in fact, if it hasn't."
Charlotte nodded. They had talked of this before. And while she knew Ruby's chances of survival would be much higher if the pregnancy had ended, she also knew that losing a second child might just destroy her.
"But, chin up," Lucien said after a moment, giving Charlotte a sad smile.
"This is the beginning of the war's end. Can't you see, if the Germans have surrendered Paris, it's only a matter of time until we take Berlin, too."
Looking around at the jubilant crowd and at the weary, smiling soldiers, Charlotte knew he was speaking the truth.
"This is a big day for us, for France, for the war."
Lucien leaned down and gave her a kiss.
"It's not a day for sadness, my love."
"I know."
Of course, he was right. But the sun looked brightest when it was emerging from the darkest clouds. And today, Charlotte feared, the storm wasn't quite over.
"I love you," Lucien said.
"I love you too, Lucien."
And together, with all the voices of Paris, they joined in the singing of the national anthem. "Arise, children of the homeland, the day of glory has arrived." The next morning, Charlotte awoke shortly after dawn to a beautiful sunrise just outside the window of the apartment she shared now with Lucien. She had been living with him since the day the police picked Ruby up in April.
and although Lucien had been back to the old building a handful of times, to check on things and to meet with Monsieur Savetier, Charlotte couldn't bring herself to go. This was her life now, until Ruby returned at least, and looking forward was easier than looking back. It was just that the past had a strange way of haunting you, even when you didn't want to think about it. If someone had told Charlotte 3 years ago that she'd be living with a boy she loved, she would have laughed out loud and then turned bright red. It simply wasn't what proper young ladies did. But things were different in wartime, and although Charlotte was only 15, she might as well have been 25. She and Lucien had seen too much, done too much to ever go back to childhood. Even after Ruby had been arrested, they had continued to work for the resistance, and that was the kind of thing that changed a person forever. Now that Paris was liberated, that work was done, and there was nothing left to do but wait. Lucien rolled over and wrapped his arms around Charlotte, pulling her closer and burrowing his face into the warm space between her neck and shoulder. He was most affectionate when he was sleeping, when his guard wasn't up, when he wasn't worrying about the things that could go wrong. She loved these moments before the world was awake, when she could pretend for a short while that she was nothing more than a girl in love with a boy. As she gazed out at the coming morning, she wondered whether Ruby could see the same sky. Were the colors of dawn, pinks, oranges, blues, as brilliant where she was as they were in Paris? Or was the sky here celebrating the liberation along with the rest of the city, while the sky to the east remained stubbornly gray? Beside her, Lucien stirred, murmuring her name as he often did upon waking. She turned and kissed his cheek, and then looked out the window again.
"What are you thinking about?" he asked softly, burying his face in her hair.
"Just that maybe somewhere out there Ruby can see the same sky," Charlotte said, closing her eyes. "Maybe one of these days the sun will rise, and as it makes its way west, she will follow it home."
Chapter 43. August 1944. On the same morning, some 1,200 miles farther south, Thomas was watching the sunrise, too. He was in the cockpit of a Spitfire, his heart pounding as he waited for takeoff. He was heading back to France, to the land where Ruby lived, to the country the Allies were in the midst of reclaiming. Now that the good guys were in control again, it no longer mattered to his superiors if he returned to France. There was no escape line to betray, no danger of being shot from the sky. His job was simply to deliver the Spit to an airfield near Ramatuelle that had, until a month ago, been an olive grove. When the Allies had arrived, the U.S. Army had bulldozed the area to create a makeshift landing strip for deliveries. This was to be a staging spot from which to wage the remainder of the war to the east. Thomas took off just past dawn, marveling, as he often did, at the glorious colors of the world at both ends of the day. Dawn and dusk were like beautiful bookends, and though the color often leached from the sky as noon approached, the day always began and ended with the same magnificent hues. Thomas smiled to himself that morning, thinking of how, when the war was over, he would take Ruby for a flight through the sunrise sky. Would the colors near the horizon, the oranges, the reds, the yellows, remind her of the poppies she'd told him about? Did the sunrises look the same over California? He thought of Ruby as he flew, wondered what she was doing right now. He'd seen the newsreel footage of the liberation of Paris, and he'd searched the jubilant crowds for her face, knowing that the odds of seeing her were slim. Still, he imagined her, with Charlotte and Lucien by her side, dancing victorious down the Avenue des Champs-Élysées. He felt a great sense of relief. She would no longer have to put herself in danger by sheltering pilots. If Paris was free, then so was Ruby. The end of the war was in sight, and one day soon he'd be able to return to her. As he flew north, he imagined that he could see all the way to the French capital, could see the French flags flying triumphant over the city once again. In what felt like no time, the French coast was upon him. Beneath the Spit, the water gleamed a perfect topaz blue. Ramatuelle, a fingernail of a village carved out beneath Saint-Tropez, seemed to rise from the edge of the sea, its rooftops glowing sherbet orange in the morning light,
as they crawled up the cliffs away from the water. He could make out a church tower, a forest beyond that, a few boats bobbing serenely in the water. He could see the airstrip in the distance, and he began to prepare for landing. And then, everything went wrong. It started with a shudder, an abrupt rat-tat-tat in the engine that felt unfamiliar and strange. Frowning, Thomas checked his instrument controls, but he didn't need them to tell him the most pressing problem. He was losing altitude and fast. Had he been hit? Had something happened to the fuel line? Was there an electrical problem? He was usually an ace at diagnosing problems and reacting calmly, but right now, he was at a loss. Everything had been fine one moment, and the next, his plane had gone haywire for no apparent reason at all. He radioed Ramatuelle with a distress call. "Can you hear me? I'm losing altitude. Need to attempt emergency landing." The only response was a faint crackle. He could see the coastline, but he wouldn't reach it, not at the rate he was falling. His mind spun as the plane continued to descend. Could he save the aircraft? To lose a Spitfire now on an errand like this seemed foolish. On the other hand, if he couldn't bring her in closer to the coast, he was out of luck. Spits weren't designed to float, and neither were the pilots enclosed in their cockpits. So that was it. He'd have to eject. The Spit was headed for the sea, and he didn't want to go with her. Quickly, fighting a wave of disappointment, he went into survival mode, ripping off his oxygen mask and radio plug and attaching his safety harness. For a frozen second, he thought of the last time he'd gone down over France, when he'd parachuted in over Saint-Omer. He thought of the things that had happened after that, the way Ruby had felt in his arms, the sense that he was living his destiny, the feeling that his life was forever tied to hers. And then he reached for the release toggle, but nothing happened. The canopy hood didn't open. He tried again, desperately, and when the switch remained stuck, he began to claw at the hood, doing his best to force it open. But the hood was jammed, and as the sickening realization hit, Thomas's heart sank. His only option was reaching the small strip of sandy, rocky beach that he could see in the distance, but he knew that it was impossible. He'd been flying Spitfires for years now, and he understood exactly what this plane was capable of, and what she couldn't do. He slammed his hands against the canopy again and again, knowing that his only chance of survival now would be to break the seal and pray that the plane's plunge into the water was gentle enough not to knock him unconscious. But the Spit was descending too quickly. As the sea rose up to meet him, he knew with a terrible certainty that this was the end. Thomas closed his eyes, and the world Ruby had painted with her words came alive. In the distance, he could see the house with the white picket fence, the one where they would raise their children together. But before he could get there, he had to make it through the brilliant sea of poppies. The flowers gleamed, beautiful, magical, just like the sunrise, and as they danced in the breeze all around him, he could feel himself smiling. They were welcoming him home. "Ruby!" he cried out, just as his Spit plunged into the shallow sea a few hundred yards from the French coast. Just beyond the poppies, there she was, smiling and beckoning, letting him know that at long last it was all right to rest. Chapter 44. August 1944. Ruby was vaguely aware of murmurs, quiet voices, whispered questions, and then something like music. She strained to listen, and it was only after a few moments that she realized what the sound was. A baby cooing. Her baby cooing. "My baby," she managed to whisper, though the world felt hazy and untenable. Where was she? How long had she been sleeping? Why couldn't she see more than foggy shapes? Ava, the farmer's wife, appeared in her field of vision, carrying a small, perfect bundle.
"You're awake, Ruby. Would you like to say hello to your daughter?"
Ruby's throat constricted as Ava brought the baby closer and placed her gently on Ruby's chest. Her vision cleared enough that she could see the baby's face in all its perfect detail. She was beautiful, healthy against all the odds. She had Thomas's brilliant blue eyes, and for a few seconds, as Ruby gazed into them, she had the feeling that Thomas was right here with her. She could hardly wait until they were together again. Soon, they'd all go home, not home to Paris, but home to the United States, the place they'd spend the rest of forever together. She knew her parents would love Thomas and their new granddaughter with all their hearts, and they'd welcome Charlotte with open arms, too. Ruby would show them the world of poppies, the way that each new day exploded in a symphony of colors and hope. She could see the future, and it was glorious. Although Ruby felt weak, she was still able to hold her baby, who was rooting around for her mother's breast. Tears came to Ruby's eyes, for she wasn't producing milk. It was impossible after Ravensbrück. "We have some milk for her," Ava said, seeming to read Ruby's mind. "She'll be all right."
"Thank you," Ruby rasped, still astonished at her good fortune to have ended up here.
She swore to herself that she would repay Ava and Fritz one day.
"What is her name?" Ava asked. "Your daughter."
Ruby smiled down at the baby in her arms for a moment without replying. She had hair the color of midnight, and the tiniest fingers and toes Ruby had ever seen. Her skin was pale, and her cheeks were pink. She was far smaller than she should have been, maybe only 5 pounds, but she was healthy and whole, which seemed impossible. She was, Ruby knew, the very definition of a miracle. And that gave her hope for the future, for if miracles could happen within her own body, they could happen anywhere. It meant that Thomas would come back to her, that Charlotte would be waiting for her in Paris.
"Nadia,"
Ruby murmured with a smile, thinking of her Russian friend who had given her this gift, this chance of survival, at the cost of her own life. The child she had saved would forever bear her name.
"Her name is Nadia. It means hope."
Ava had tears in her eyes as she smiled down at Ruby and the baby.
"Nadia," she said softly. "A beautiful name."
"Yes." Ruby gazed down at her daughter, who looked up at her mother's face, searching.
"My sweet little girl, you will have a good life, my darling. I promise you."
"Ruby," Ava said after a few minutes, "I have some news for you. Paris was liberated a few days ago. The Allies are headed east. It is only a matter of time."
"Paris was liberated?" Ruby felt breathless, and she imagined joy flooding through the capital, people dancing in the streets, the French flag flying once again. Charlotte would be safe now, and that alone was enough to bring tears of joy to Ruby's eyes.
"Thank God."
She drew a ragged breath.
"May I ask one more thing of you? There are 3 letters I'd like to write, just in case something happens to me."
"Of course."
Ava went to retrieve a few pieces of paper and a pen, and when she returned, she offered to hold Nadia while Ruby wrote. But Ruby didn't want to let go, and so she cradled her daughter in the crook of her left arm while writing shakily with her right hand. When she was done, she addressed the letters, one to her parents, one to Thomas in care of the RAF, and one to Charlotte in care of Lucien, and handed them to Ava.
"Thank you," she whispered.
"There's no need to thank me."
Ava eventually took Nadia and fed her milk from a bottle as Ruby drifted off. When she awoke, it was morning, and she could have sworn she'd heard an explosion somewhere in the distance.
"Has something happened?" she asked, struggling to the surface.
Ava was there beside her, cradling Nadia, and she looked startled by Ruby's abrupt question.
"I don't think so."
"I thought I heard a noise,"
Ruby murmured, focusing on her daughter's face. Ava rose and placed Nadia on Ruby's chest once more, and Ruby touched her lips to the top of her daughter's head, feeling her soft, downy hair. Ruby was hot, so hot, but the baby's skin was cool, and Ruby knew she would be okay.
"My sweet little girl," she murmured, "one day soon you will meet your father, and your Aunt Charlotte, and your Uncle Lucien, and your grandmother and grandfather. They'll all love you so much, my sweet angel, just like I do."
Ava left the room as Ruby cooed to the baby, and she returned a moment later with a wet cloth, which she put on Ruby's forehead.
You're burning up, my dear, she said. She reached for Nadia, but Ruby held on tightly, shaking her head.
Please, she whispered. Not yet.
Ava nodded, backing away, but Ruby could see concern in her eyes.
What day is today? Ruby asked, because she wanted to remember everything about the start of her child's life.
Wednesday, August 30th, Ava replied. Ruby's eyes filled with tears. She tried to take a deep breath, but there was pressure on her lungs and she couldn't quite inhale.
I know. I have no right to ask anything else of you, she began, but please promise me again that you will protect my baby.
I swear it on my life, Ava said firmly, and Ruby believed her. Sleep now, Ruby.
It's okay. You've saved your daughter. I did. I really did. And now I'll see Thomas very soon.
Yes, Ava agreed. She had moved to Ruby's side and was stroking her forehead.
And Charlotte? And my parents?
Yes. Ava's words and the cool touch of her hand were so soothing. Against her brittle, hollowed chest, Ruby could feel her baby's heartbeat, and she smiled, relaxing into the rhythm. For the first time in years, she knew in the depths of her soul that everything would be okay.
Nadia, she whispered as the world faded away once again. Thomas.
And then she closed her eyes, and the poppy fields were there, their vibrant, familiar colors bright against the crisp blue sky. It had to be a dream, didn't it? But there was her house, the one she'd grown up in, and beside it, impossibly, was the home she had talked of building one day, a whitewashed cottage with a white picket fence, exactly as she'd imagined it. She could feel the fresh desert air. She could feel the grass whispering beneath her feet. She could smell the fragrance of her mother's apple pie wafting from the open window of her parents' kitchen. Somewhere in the distance, Fred Astaire sang cheek to cheek. Ruby began to walk toward the house, and that's when she saw Thomas emerging from the poppies. He looked just as he had when she'd last seen him, handsome and strong and full of hope. Ruby, he called, and all at once his arms were open and she was running toward him. She had always known, somewhere deep inside, that she would see him again, but this still felt like a miracle.
Thomas, she cried as she fell into him, and that's when she knew for sure this wasn't a dream. He was warm and solid and real.
Soon, she would tell him about Nadia, about the way her blue eyes sparkled, about the way her hair was feather soft, about the way she looked just like him. She would tell him that she had saved their daughter, but that it was he who had saved her all those years before by giving her a reason to live. She would tell him that she loved him, that she intended to spend the rest of eternity by his side, if he'd have her. There would be time for all of that, but for now, she only wanted to feel his arms around her, to hear his heartbeat, to breathe him in. She looked down and realized she looked just as she had that day in 1941 when Thomas had first arrived at her door on the Rue Amélie. Her curves were once again ample, her skin glowing. Her dress was white, silky as a feather, billowy as a cloud. The poppy fields were familiar and unfamiliar at the same time, but their brilliant colors, more brilliant than she'd ever seen, soothed her. She knew she was exactly where she was meant to be, and as she found her home at last in Thomas's arms, she could see the future stretching before them, beautiful and bright.
Chapter 45. March 2002. We reach the top of the hill just as the sun is nearing the horizon. I'd tried at first to push my darling girl through the fields in her wheelchair, but it had been too much, the wheels lodged in the mud. So I'd scooped her into my arms and carried her, like a bride over the threshold, the rest of the way. My whole body hurts, but I don't care. Being able to hold her one last time, to feel her heartbeat against mine, is worth the pain. Spreading below us now is the vast swath of poppy fields we inherited from Ruby's parents when they died in 1947. My wife has always said that she feels Ruby's presence here, especially when the poppies are in bloom. For a long time I never felt it, but I do now. Now I believe. After the war, the Red Cross was able to get word to Ruby's parents